everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Katie Halper Show. This is our first regularly timed, regularly programmed Katie Halper Show since the great Cuba convoy trip that I took part in, along with hundreds of others. So thank you guys so much for coming to this show. We have a wonderful show for you. If people don't know, we were in Cuba starting the 20th, and then I had some trouble getting back in. I, along with around 19 other people who are on this convoy, and we talked about that a little bit on a special stream that we did on Sunday. But we are going to be talking about Cuba today, but we're also going to be talking about Iran and Russia and Palestine and Gaza and all the places that the United States is trying to wreak havoc upon with the, of course, help of Israel. Now, before we do bring on our amazing guests, please do like the stream. Give it a like. That's a great way to fight back against the algorithmic suppression. Also got to show CBP and ICE that we're not discouraged from watching the show, despite the fact that its host was stopped by them. And hi, CBP, if you're watching. I am on a new laptop. Maybe I shouldn't tell them that, but I am on a new laptop in case it looks different to anyone. Also, please do become Patreon supporters if you can at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. If you can support us at $1 a month, you make this show happen, which we literally could not do without your support. Not an exaggeration. We couldn't do without your support. And if you can swing it and if you can afford $5 a month, we highly encourage that, because then you get extended interviews, bonus content. You'll get early access to some great Cuba interviews that I did, including a great chat I did with Kneecap. I did a little Q&A with Kneecap, the Irish rap trio that raps in Irish, and all sorts of other things that I'll talk about later on in the show. Also, do please subscribe so you don't miss these streams, especially because we are doing these additional streams. We do them on weekends sometimes so that we can talk to people live in Iran, or we do them when one of us gets questioned and detained by CBP and we want to give updates. So to do that, you hit subscribe and then the bell. Okay, so I'm going to start the show. The second half is going to be wonderful. It's going to be mixed emotions. It's going to be about how the U.S. blockade against Cuba is killing people, but also how the fearless and incredibly devoted doctors in Cuba are overcoming incredible odds to manage to actually save people in ways that the doctors in the West would just not be able to do. And I will be talking to Uriel Ramirez, who is a doctor who studied in Cuba. And I will be talking to Ed Augustin, who is based in Cuba and has an amazing front page on the New York Times report about the impact of the blockade on hospitals. And I'm sure he got that New York Times front page article on the front page because he got that preemptive Katie Halper Show bump. I like to think that CBP and everyone was all up in my internets and messages, and they probably saw that I was corresponding with Ed, and they thought it'd be a good idea because he was such a big deal that they would put him on the front page of the New York Times. At least that's the way I see it. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. So without further ado, so thrilled to be bringing back onto the show two faves. We are going to be speaking to Lawrence Wilkerson, retired U.S. Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. He's an anti-war critic of U.S. foreign policy and a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Also coming back onto the show is Jose Luis Granado Ceja, who is a writer and photojournalist based in Mexico City. He has a great podcast called the Soberania Podcast, and he also has been doing great coverage for DropSite. So welcome, Colonel Wilkerson, and welcome, Jose Luis.
Good to be with you, Katie.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming.
Your Spanish pronunciation is incredible. It must be the Cuba effect.
It is. It's rubbing off on me. Yeah. I got Havana syndrome, and then I got the Cuba accent. Although if it were Cuban accent, it would be very hard to understand for people who aren't Cuban, I think. So there's so much to be talking about, and I really do feel honored to have you two on, as well as our guests later on in the show, because you all have such important perspectives. Jose Luis, you're based in Mexico. Colonel Wilkerson, you are someone who has been involved in the military and the government at very high-ranking positions. And so your insights are, I would say, extremely important right now, especially because you, Jose Luis, are living in one of the places that is, I would say, playing a major role in what we're seeing. We talk a lot about Russia, Iran, China, Israel, Palestine, but we also want to make sure that we cover South America, Latin America, really, because that is an important part of what we're seeing. And I guess I want to start off with you, though, Colonel Wilkerson, if you could just situate us in where you think we are right now on the world stage. I mean, it's a bit of an overwhelming question, but what do you think the most important things that are happening right now all around the world that we really need to focus on the most for all of our safety?
Number one, we need to focus on what this disastrous war of choice against Iran, and really rapidly becoming against other people too, by extension, if not cause, and what it's going to do to us and what it's going to do to the world. And let me just give you a very vivid example. The first tier targets that Iran struck were struck with brutal efficiency, exquisite intelligence, and almost incredible accuracy. So, for example, in Bahrain, they destroyed the largest refining facility in the Persian Gulf, completely destroyed it. I talked to oil men today about what it would take to put it back together again. It's going to be questionable whether they try to put it back together again, because it's so difficult to do when it's been destroyed so methodically and so thoroughly. They did that to other places. They knew about the Israeli, the Mossad, CIA, MI6 facility in Erbil, Kurdistan, for example. They had struck it a couple of times before just to let Israel, they knew it was there. Well, they destroyed it this time, utterly destroyed it. They did so with enormous amount of caution in terms of civilian casualties and other things associated with it. They just struck the targets. At Prince Sultan Air Base, they struck some of our most sophisticated aircraft and set them afire. That's the first set of targets they have. There's a second tier of targets, and that second tier is going to be everything that is associated with the world economy of significant importance, and they're going to strike it with the same kind of lethality and the same kind of intelligence and accuracy. Take, for example, Ras Tanura. 550,000 barrel per day capacity oil facility in Saudi Arabia, or the other one, I forget the name right now. It's about 7 million barrels per day. It's 7% of the oil supply. It's everything. It's refineries, compounds. So if they strike these things, we're going into global depression, not just recession. We're going into global depression. There are going to be some countries that'll benefit majorly from it, like Russia. But not very many. And Russia eventually will feel the impact too, because the world's so globalized now. So this struggle of choice that Trump has decided to start, mostly, I think, because of Bibi Netanyahu, is going to turn into a real disaster if we're not careful and if we don't stop it very soon. I say he should declare victory and leave and let Mr. Netanyahu stir in his own juices. Declare victory and leave. I mean, he's good at doing that sort of thing, but I don't think he's going to do that. So I think we're in trouble.
So you're saying Trump should just fake victory and then leave. Yep. He's good at faking things. He's good at lying. Now, why won't he do that?
I think it's basically Israel, because he knows if he does that, Israel might be toast and Israel might go to a nuclear weapon.
So is it that they would be toast and then they would, out of this position, use a nuke? That's his fear, that they would use a nuke, or is he fearful about what would happen to Israel?
I think both, but I think mostly what he's concerned about is that he doesn't have any control over Netanyahu and his nuclear stockpile. Same thing that happened in 73, but you had Moscow and Washington weighing in with Golda Meir. You had Henry Kissinger orchestrating things, and you had us telling the Israelis, no, 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 both Moscow and Washington. And they happened to get a position on the Egyptian Third Army that meant they didn't have to use the nuclear weapon. So it all went away in 73, it's not going to go away this time, I don't think.
So if you were advising the president, not just the way you are right now through the Katie Halper Show, but if you really had his ear, what would you tell him to do, given that Israel does have nuclear weapons that you yourself have said you think they'd be fine using?
I think he's got to figure out a way to extricate himself from this, if he cares at all about his presidency and if he cares at all about the country, both of which I'm not sure about. So I don't know that there's an incentive to do this. The more I listen to him, the more I think his megalomania has really conquered him. So as I said, I think we're in deep trouble. And unfortunately, I think much of the world is in deep trouble because this is going to have huge repercussions. And we're not even talking about Ukraine and the ground hardening up and Russia mounting an onslaught on Odessa, now fueled with $160 to $170 million a day more. They don't have any pains with regard to funding their campaign in Ukraine because they're just rolling in dough now with the oil they get, oil price. So it's a very dangerous world. And I don't think Donald Trump understands what he started.
Let's say you were president, okay? What would you do? Is there anything that we can do to defang Israel?
I'm not sure. I don't know what he said to Netanyahu in the past, and I don't know how far he's willing to go with Miriam Adelson and other of his backers who are quite critical to his reelection or staying in office and not being impeached, and also the reelection of the Republican Party in the Congress. Hopefully not his reelection, but I don't put that beyond the ken. So I don't know. I wouldn't know how to advise him. I would tell him, if I were the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State, to whom none of whom he listens to, but if I had his ear, I would say, you need to break this embrace with Bibi Netanyahu, and you need to make it very clear to him that he needs to stop. He needs to stop in Lebanon. He needs to stop in Syria. He needs to stop in Gaza. He needs to stop on the West Bank. And we need to sit down and do something about redeveloping some sort of peace plan and a solution. I don't think the solution is two states anymore, but I do think there could be a democratic state in the Levant that was both Palestinian and Jew to start with, and then turned into a true democracy and entertain both populations with a manner of respect and dignity that a democracy should. And to hell with the power of the womb, to hell with all of that. We need a democratic state in the Levant, or we need no state other than Palestine.
And Jose, I will shift to you in a second. I just really want to get to this because I'm very curious. If you were president, let's just say, Colonel Wilkerson, would you be able to, I guess my question is, can anyone stop Israel? Let's say you were totally committed. You didn't care about Adelson. What could be done? How do we know that they wouldn't just use nuclear weapons? Like if the U.S. stopped funding them today and stopped arming them today, would they then just use a nuke?
You could stop them quite simply. It wouldn't be easy to orchestrate, but it's a simple solution. The first thing you do is don't drop the 82nd Ready Brigade on Iran, where it's going to get slaughtered. Drop it on Dimona. And then tell the Israelis, you are not using this for war. And oh, by the way, you know the categories of munitions that you are 2 days supply, 4 days supply, 6 days supply, 8 days supply. I've seen the chart. You know those munitions that you are very, very short on and that are critical to your survival? I'll stop them all tomorrow morning, every one of them. Now let's talk. Shut this down. Lebanon, Gaza, West Bank, all of it, shut it down. And then take yourself out of office.
That'd be great, yeah. And Dimona, of course, is where the nuclear research center is.
Right. And supposedly the stockpile, though, I heard from reliable sources that they've dispersed some of it. So that's not good. Probably because they didn't want Iran to hit it. But at the second thought, maybe it's because they want to use it.
Right. Oh, gosh. Okay. So, Jose Luis, tell us what you are seeing from where you are. What are the concerns that people are having? Because you're based in Mexico, but you cover quite a bit in your analysis. What are the biggest concerns, you think, in the global South, in Latin America? And also, what role is Mexico playing? And can Mexico play in what's happening right now, ranging from what we're seeing in Cuba to other conflicts?
You know, I would start by saying that I think a lot of what we're seeing maybe doesn't happen if there had been stronger pushback against the invasion, the bombing, and the kidnapping of Nicolás Maduro. I think, and I've seen many others share this view, that Trump, in a sense, was drunk on his victory and felt that it was going to be, you know, with all due respect to the Venezuelan resistance, to the Cubans who died, the Venezuelans who tried to protect Maduro, that it would be as easy as it was there. And it clearly wasn't. And I think there was a sore miscalculation there. And so my concern is that he has said so, you know, people in his administration have said as much, that as soon as they're done in Iran, they're going to turn their attention back to the region. And I think their conduct in Venezuela, the support for the genocide, this attack by United States and Israel against Iran, shows just how far they're willing to go. And so one of the things that I've kind of been trying to stress in terms of my analysis of this moment is that we can't operate as if there really is a rules-based order, if there is actually any kind of regard for international law. And that makes for a more dangerous world. You know, I recently wrote a column that for the Mexico Solidarity Project. They have a bulletin. It's a weekly thing, and I publish once a month, basically making a call for Mexico to emulate Iran and develop a real deterrence strategy. We'll never be able to take on the United States militarily, not directly, certainly not the, I mean, considering that they wouldn't even have to do an amphibious landing. We share a border with them. That would not be a very long conflict, I think, in a lot of ways. Maybe it would drag out into kind of a guerrilla conflict. But really, you know, this idea that what Iran is implementing in this moment, that they need to make sure that the cost is too high, that people understand that attacking a country to violate its sovereignty in that way would come at an extraordinarily high price. And of course, Mexico has leverage. I think a lot of people seem to underestimate the role that Mexico plays in the U.S. economy. You know, for sure, it's an asymmetric relationship. Obviously, you know, there is definitely a richer, more powerful country between the two of them. But the United States needs Mexico. And so I think there nearly needs to be a greater appreciation for that. But I really want to stress, it makes for a more dangerous world. You know, and I think much of Latin America is saying the same thing. You know, I was inspired by some of the comments that I saw from Celso Almorín, who's not a radical in any sense. He's a longtime diplomat. He's kind of a, you know, a left of center kind of personality, key advisor to Lula, saying the same exact thing, that Brazil needs to think about what deterrence looks like. And this is the world that now Donald Trump, the Republican Party, and I would say more broadly, the Washington establishment has created. And so now we're looking at this scenario where every calculation is what is going to be sort of the worst case scenario. So this brings me to Cuba. I've seen a lot of criticism, and I think, you know, some of it is appropriate, that why didn't Mexico break the blockade? You know, why did it have to take, you know, a Russian vessel to finally deliver oil when Mexico was right next door and had become the number one supplier? You know, we saw Trump threaten Mexico with tariffs, and Mexico actually in previous occasions was able to push back against Trump's tariff threats quite effectively. And then actually we saw the Supreme Court strike down the IEEPA tariffs, which was the basis for the threat against Mexico. And yet Mexico didn't send oil. So that tells me the threat was never tariffs. The threat was military action. I mean, I feel pretty confident in saying that. And I think that is what really spooked this government here in Mexico to not take that step. Because, of course, we know that there are many elements inside the White House right now who want to engage in unilateral military action against Mexico, using organized crime groups as the excuse. But really, it's about, you know, treating everything as a nail when you're a hammer. And so there was this concern that if Mexico provoked the United States by sending oil, that that would be the response. Now, you would say, well, they would just stick to, you know, organized crime groups, and they would bomb drug labs. We just saw last week the revelation, which actually came out earlier in Ecuadorian media, but we saw this kind of splashy headline in the Times, that this joint attack by the United States and Ecuador in the border regions in Ecuadorian territory that they claimed was the first joint action, it turns out it was a dairy farm. And that's exactly what would happen in Mexico. So I think the fear of unilateral military action by the United States against Mexico is a very legitimate one. So in terms of, you know, the resistance, I think the idea now really, and we haven't seen enough of it, is that there has to be a continental strategy. You know, there was a time here where there was talk about a united defense pact between the countries of Latin America, and at the height of the Pink Tide, when we had, you know, a strong, robust CELAC community of Latin American and Caribbean states, when we had a strong, robust UNASUR, they actually got much further in terms of these discussions about a joint defense pact. That's what we need to be talking about now, because it's far more difficult, I think, in terms of the calculations that likely would be made in terms of a potential attack against Mexico, if they know that the rest of the region would be behind the country. Obviously, that's really difficult given some of the leadership in this region, Noboa in Ecuador, Bukele in El Salvador. It wouldn't be a entire region united under a single agreement. But certainly, if, you know, these larger economies, these kind of Mexico, Colombia, Brazil, at the very least, coming together to actually talk about how we survive in this climate. And, you know, I think the scenario that Mr. Wilkerson here has just pictured for us is exactly why we should be motivated to do it very urgently.
I mean, I've asked this on many shows before. Why isn't there something for, I mean, I would love to see kind of a Pan-American, Latin American cooperation, but what about getting countries ranging from, you know, Cuba, Venezuela, but also Iran, Russia, China, South Africa, like a BRICS plus coalition? Because it seems to me like the argument of the labor movement, which of course has been decimated, but, you know, there's power in numbers, and you can't, you know, the United States and all the European nations and Israel, they will not be swayed by morality. I mean, there's no one here, none of the three of us, nor the people who are coming on later, nor the most of the people watching the show for a second think that that would happen. So it does seem like there needs to be some kind of entity that pushes back.
Yeah, it's an idea that is as old as Simón Bolívar. He talked about the need for this.
Right.
I was just thinking about him.
And so, you know, the moment demands that we retake these ideas, that we take up these ideas again. And it's unfortunate that we're not seeing it. I think many, many regional players are basically out to just survive, to just kind of wait things out. I do think that there is a lot of credibility to the notion that maybe Trump doesn't get out of this one, right? Like, it could cost him his presidency. I mean, it is really, really delicate right now. But, you know, the argument we make is that, you know, I call it the strategic retreat, right? This idea that, you know, that the United States is kind of refocusing on what is called traditional spheres of influence. But I heard a really good metaphor when I was in Bogota, which is that if you think about it in boxing terms, when a boxer is losing, how does he retreat? He doesn't do so quietly. He does so punching. And so that creates a pretty dangerous scenario. But even then, it doesn't have to necessarily be a military strategy. I've always thought that a regional oil pact could go really far. There is a significant amount of oil production here, essentially the equivalent of what is now no longer passing through the Strait of Hormuz, around 15 million barrels. That's a significant amount. That's the kind of amount that you can push your weight around if you actually get united and be able to leverage that, but that requires, you know, a lot of cooperation. And there's, you know, some inklings of it. You know, apparently Petrobras, the Brazilian state oil company, is interested in some kind of joint venture with Pemex. I think that's fine, but that can only really go so far. There has to be, I think, a longer-term vision in terms of, again, how do we actually create a certain kind of deterrence so that, you know, if they try to blockade Cuba again, we say, well, then we're going to cut off our oil supplies. That is significant. But Mexico on its own probably can't do that much, not enough. Brazil on its own, same thing, right? But altogether, I think, as you say, that is the classic union saying, right? United, we are far more strong.
Yeah, united we stand, divided we fall. It also reminds me of, you know, this is, sounds a little ridiculous, but my ADHD is really being triggered now by having multiple devices, I got to say. And, you know, I feel like the world, the global South, the world that is not part of the U.S.-Israeli axis needs to, we're always putting out fires. Like, I know I'm putting out fires. And if I front load my work and take a deep breath, I'm much more productive. I know this is ridiculous, like life hack tips for me, but I do feel like if there was more of a coordinated vision and more coordination, these, you know, nations would be able to breathe a little bit more and not constantly try to whatever to defend their borders, talk Trump down from an invasion.
Absolutely.
You're getting ready to get, the world's getting ready to get, and you may have ambivalent views about it. I don't. I think it's a positive move. The American press has missed this completely. When Deng Xiaoping started Chinese capitalism with Chinese characteristics, he essentially said there are a number of things we need to do. One of them was to capture 95% of the rare earth metals market, which they proceeded to do and gave them immense power in the technological realm. But other things that he said to do have been happening slowly but surely. Hu Jintao put out a couple of edicts. Xi Jinping has put out a couple. This latest one he just put out, I have not seen a single mainstream media video or paper pick up. What he says in it, essentially, is he declares China as having achieved in technological terms, in economic terms in general, in military terms, in other terms of state power, preeminence or equality. Then he says at the bottom of the edict, very short thing in Mandarin, he says, but there's one area that we are not globally triumphant in. And now we're going to do that area. We're going to substitute the renminbi for the dollar. We're going to turn the current financial system in the world out. It's going to be gone. And we're going to take it over. We'll start with the rupee and the renminbi and the Russian currency. I forget what it is, but those are the three currencies we'll start with, sort of like a BRICS game, if you will. I suspect they'll pull Brazil into it before it's over because I've heard Lula talk about this very thing. And I think he would have already made an overture about it, except he got it from Trump. When he even talked about doing that sort of thing. But they're going to do it now because Xi is going to provide them with the leadership, and that is going to cause our debt to go out of all proportion. We will not be able to deflate our debt by having the world's currency and everybody buying our debt because no one will want to buy our debt. So we're getting ready to get some major global comeuppance as a state power, and that's going to put the world on a different plane in terms of the way people get along with each other, I think, because China's predominant process is development. It's not conquering you. They're not fighting wars with people. They're not sanctioning people. A recent report came out about a week ago. Everyone should read this report. 38 million people have been killed since 2000 by American sanctions. 50% of them are women and children. That's just sanctions. Now add Afghanistan, Libya, Somalia, Iraq, and now Iran. Add those casualties to it, direct war casualties. We're going to be right up there with Mao Zedong, Stalin, and even Hitler in terms of people on the globe we have been responsible for the death of. The world knows that now. And Xi Jinping is giving the world an avenue to get out of this mess, to absolutely eliminate our sanctions, because we won't be able to govern the sanctions anymore if we don't have the world's transactional reserve currency. We can't do it anymore. SWIFT system will be gone. Bretton Woods will be gone. The whole thing will be gone. And China will remake it in its image, as Xi Jinping said in this edict. So we're getting ready to get a kick in the butt in this empire. And it's not going to be a saluable kick. It's going to be terrible. It's going to take us a long time to recover from it. I mean, we're not going away. We're 340 million people blessed by divine providence with rivers and land out the yin yang and so forth. But we are going to take a back seat for a considerable amount of time. And China's going to take the front seat along with Russia and India and Brazil and other countries like that. Questions are, where will Japan go? It's disappearing demographically. Where will some of the other powers go, like Indonesia, which is huge, but not met its full potential yet? But these countries will all find a way into this conglomerate, if you will, And the United States will find itself on the back burner.
One of my favorite things about being a host is I love putting interesting people together who may not without this, you know, otherwise meet. So I really, that was a great meeting of minds. If you haven't already, please do like the stream. Also, I'm gonna just encourage people. We want people to be able to see this show, and we would love for people to just throw down $12 a year to keep the show going. Sorry if that sounds corny, like I'm doing a pitch, but let's see if we can get any new Patreon supporters by the end of the stream. And I will check on my old phone. I won't be able to check on my laptop, and I'll let you know. But that would be very exciting if we got some Patreon supporters. Doesn't have to be $5. You could just do $1 a month. Okay. So without any further ado, we are bringing on... Oh, and by the way, if you're watching now, you're in luck because you're going to get to see this entire show. If you're watching later and you want to see the full thing, including a lot of gems, you can do that at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. So now we are going to bring on our next two guests for the second segment of the show. I'm really excited. Both of these guests are making their Katie Halper Show debut. We will be speaking to Ed Augustin, who is a journalist based in Havana, and he has a great front page New York Times story called "Cuban Patients Are Dying Because of the U.S. Blockade, Doctors Say." And he also broadcasts for NBC News, Al Jazeera, and France 24. And he writes for places like the Financial Times, the New York Times, and the Guardian. And we are also being joined by Dr. Uriel Ramirez, who was born and raised in Los Angeles, is a graduate of the Latin American School of Medicine in Havana, Cuba, and is currently based in New Mexico. He's also the founder of the Pan American Medical Association. And he collaborates with the William Soler Hospital in Havana, Cuba, which is the hospital that Ed covered for this very important article. So welcome, Ed and Uriel. Thank you so much for joining.
Lovely to be here.
And of course, it's dark where you are, Ed. How's the power right now in Havana?
No power where I am right now.
Okay. Well, the power of the laptop is working well. I want to thank you guys both so much for coming on and for everything that you do. But I guess I want to start off by asking, as a segue from what we were just talking about, if you can talk, Ed, about the effects that you're seeing right now from the blockade, but also how people in Cuba are receiving the news about the Russian oil tanker.
Yeah, well, the effects of the oil, of the U.S. oil blockade, today is the first time in around about 3 months that a significant amount of petroleum has come into the country. And that's quite a phenomenal thing. Right, like I don't know of another. It's quite literally a blockade, and it's quite literally an oil blockade because there is other commerce from the United States and other countries. So it's the United States stopping oil coming in, and it's a funny moment in Cuba because the communist government has been insisting for decades it's not an embargo, it's a blockade. Population have long been tired of that kind of tired rhetoric. And yet the Trump administration have kind of become more communist than the communists in the last few months because you have Trump boasting on Truth Social, I think it was, that it's a total and complete blockade. You have Mike Hammer, the rather inept and comic charge d'affaires here, who fancies himself as a social media star, talking about how there's a complete blockade, nothing's getting in, according to CNN, he told diplomats. And so it's a funny moment that you have kind of like... The Trump administration rhetoric has kind of like out-communisted the commies, and in terms of policy, it's brutal. They haven't allowed almost any significant amount of support to come in. Unsurprisingly, that's been devastating for the Cuban people. Often, when it gets reported on, journalists focus on the economic, you know, like the Cuban economy teetering on the edge, the regime on the verge of collapse, all of this stuff. But I think that, and in part because of what you were talking about at the beginning of the show, right? Like war tends to, dropping missiles on kids tends to be seen as warmongering or war, whereas economic sanctions for some reason tend to get seen as the other end of the binary. This is like not war, it's peace. And so because of this whole kind of like ideological construction, There's precious little reporting on the humanitarian effects of sanctions, even though we know, according to peer-reviewed academic literature, that economic sanctions kill. Even though we know they kill about as many people a year as war. Even though we know most of the people they kill are children, because life is most fragile in the first months and years. And that just came through really, really clearly in the reporting I've done for the piece you mentioned. You know, we went to some of the top maternity hospitals, I should say in Havana, right? In the rest of the country, things are far worse. And we had over half a dozen doctors telling us very, very clearly, this oil blockade is killing patients. And just to give you a few analogies, right? I have a friend, a source, who's an anesthesiologist in the William Soleil Hospital. It's the biggest pediatric hospital in the country. And we included it in the article. There have been three nationwide power cuts this month of March that's just finishing today. And during one of the nationwide power cuts, while he was involved in an operation, the lights went out, the power went out in the hospital. And they did, and they do, have backup diesel. They're worried about how long it's going to last for. But it takes a few minutes for the generator to kick in and for the technicians to restart the machines because they have to be reloaded and rebooted and the power has to be set up. And so during the power cut, there was a two-month-old child, infant rather, and he couldn't see the vital signs because the screen blanks out. And so what he said to me is, it only lasts a minute, but it feels like an eternity. That child survived. Others don't. In the same hospital, nurses were making contingency plans about what they'd do if sick infants in incubators, that are often born early, and so their body temperature has to be raised. They were talking about what they'd do if the backup generator ran out of diesel. There's real fear about that, and they were talking about just taking them out and putting them in swaddling cloths and putting them back inside the incubators. And what's amazing is sort of like quote unquote first world journalist is one thinks this is incredibly dramatic. When you speak to the Cubans, and I wonder if Uriel would have some comment on this, they kind of shrug their shoulders. It's like, you know, this is normal. We've been through this a million times. They kind of like find it a bit odd actually that you, a journalist, would inquire into this. One final thing. The sanctions have been killing Cubans prior to the oil blockade, right? So Cuba has had very, very good healthcare, incredibly good, you know, like consistently throughout the decades, lower infant mortality rates in the United States, one of the highest doctor-patient ratios in the world, life expectancy comparable with rich countries, I could go on. But it's always been under sanctions. But they could cope with that, right? Because they prioritized healthcare so much. That changed around 2019. Because in 2019, the first Trump administration smashed Cuba with so-called maximum pressure sanctions. And a year later, the pandemic came, and the pandemic shuttered tourism and sent the economy into a big tailspin. And so those two things, that 1-2 punch, have led to an enormous recession in Cuba. The economy has contracted a huge amount. And even though a fifth of state budgets are spent on healthcare, which is far higher than the Latin American average, over the last 10 years, the infant mortality rate has more than doubled. And so I think it's important to highlight to people that the oil blockade is getting a bit of media coverage right now because it's just so brazen, right? As well as the ridiculous Trump rhetoric that he's going to take Cuba and all of that. But actually, under Biden, when they were sticking to the whole nonsense about, you know, we love human rights and democracy, and they just didn't talk about sanctions, even though they kept the Trump sanctions in place, they were still killing people. They're still killing a lot of people fundamentally because they aim at bankrupting the state, and the state can't afford enough food for pregnant women, and so babies were being born underweight. They can't afford enough milk for young children, so children aren't eating what they ought to, because there's not enough petrol, and so there's power cuts everywhere and people are getting dengue fever, for example, and food's going off, and also because by bankrupting the state, they've decimated the budget for medicines, both imported medicines and domestic medicine production. And so I was speaking to a woman in a hospital, one of the head gynecologists in a hospital just six blocks away from here. And she said, we see more and more mothers that can't get hold of antibiotics. And so in recent years, we're seeing more and more premature and extremely premature babies that are being born too early and dying because the mothers just can't get hold of the antibiotics they need. And so this policy kills, not just the new Trump's policy of an oil blockade, the Trump one and the Biden policy has been killing, and the main people it's been killing is babies. And I just finished by saying this. If Vladimir Putin had a policy which, regardless of his intentions, had the consequence of killing Ukrainian babies, we'd probably be hearing about it, wouldn't we, from US politicians? If President Xi had a policy of killing, for example, Taiwanese babies, we'd be hearing about it and the media would be have been pretty vocal. I think the silence, the relative silence from media and politicians says an awful lot.
Yeah. And again, all these people who claim to care about Cuba, all these people who want a regime change, quote unquote, because they care about the suffering of the Cuban people, if they actually cared at all, and weren't motivated by other things, grievance, politics, vindictiveness, whatever, they would, of course, be calling on the end of a blockade because they, in theory, wouldn't want children and kids to be killed. So, Uriel, how does this compare to what you witnessed? And I know that it's not just what you witnessed in the past when you were in medical school there, but you're in touch with the doctors at this hospital. So can you tell us about what they're telling you? And also tell us about what you know that they do in order to save as many lives as they can. Because one of the things I'm shocked by is, this was my fourth time in Cuba, and one of the things I'm always shocked by is how they do so much with fewer resources. And we in the United States have so many resources and we do so little with them when it comes to education and healthcare. We do a lot of things when it comes to war, et cetera. But tell us about this difference here.
So, yeah, I just want to piggyback back with what Ed was saying. You know, this all this was started, you know, back in like 2019. I lived during the Obama years and the Trump era and the Biden era in Cuba. And so I got the privilege to see all three presidents just go through what Cuba went through. And it was quite interesting because, you know, during the Obama era, we had everything. We had syringes, we had supplies, you know, we were being very wasteful too. You know, we had a lot of stuff. We would use it and we would just, you know, we didn't think anything of it. Once the Trump administration came in, it was just scarcity all around, you know. And then once the pandemic hit, it was just horrible. We didn't have enough supplies. We didn't know what to do. People starting to die. You know, we didn't have this. We didn't have that. And like the Cuban says, you know, no hay. You know, and it became a reality for a lot of Cubans. You know, no hay this, no hay that, no hay café, no hay esto. And it just became the culture in Cuba. Keep in mind, they've been through harsh times before, which they call periodos especiales. But this one definitely, this periodo especial has taken a toll on the Cuban people, you know, because the mortality has definitely gone up over the years. I remember working with the anesthesiologist that Ed was talking about. His name is Dr. Aliot Fernandez Valle. He's the vice president of the SCAR, which is the Sociedad Médica de Anestesiología in Cuba. And he, we got together one day and we were like, man, we got to do something about this. We were in the OR back in 2020 and we couldn't do surgeries on children because we didn't have sutures, you know, something so basic and simple. And we just didn't have it. And kids couldn't get the life-saving treatment that was needed, you know. And so I took it upon myself using the resources that I had and the privilege that I had as an American to come back and ask people, you know, like, hey, you know, Cuba is going through a crisis. We need supplies. And I started going on social media and it became something part of me, something innate that it was successful. And I started sending medical supplies to Cuba. And that's why I created my nonprofit, Pan American Medical Association. This would allow me to legally send medical supplies to Cuba, you know, and get the licenses necessary to keep on sending supplies to Cuba. And so it was something, at first, it was something very amazing, you know, because I was able to do something great, you know, send about $3 million worth of medical supplies. And then, after that, once the Trump regime came in again, it became a lot harder to send medical supplies. And currently, the situation has gotten extremely bad, where, like Ed was saying, and I had the personal privilege to work directly with Dr. Aliot. I talk to him directly every day because he's my mentor. He just tells me that it's difficult. You know, it's been the worst it's ever been his entire life. He just doesn't know what to do in these situations. He's such a great doctor and he's such a great physician. And I have the privilege to work with him because he's a humanitarian, not just a physician, you know, and he cares about these children. And when a child dies on him, it takes a toll on him. You know, it's not as easy as anybody thinks, you know, as a physician. And when you don't have the life-saving supplies to save that child, it's just devastating as a physician. It's just something that brings you to tears and you just contemplate life and you contemplate what is going on, what kind of evil is this, and why is this happening?
Can you also talk about, I mean, obviously this is, what you said is incredibly important. I just also want people to realize though that there is, I'm not trying to sugarcoat what's happening, but there is such amazing creativity and resilience and dedication among Cuban doctors. So, and a lot of preparedness. Now they can't totally mitigate against all these things and people are dying because of the blockade. But there was a rumor one night that, you know, because of an outage that all these people died because they were on ventilators. And then I heard that actually there's things that are set up. So they're generators, they're backup generators. And then you'll do things by hand, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of manual labor in the medicine in Cuba. And you'll notice that even the way they teach us is taught to us that we are able to diagnose without machines and without things. And so they teach us since the inception of medicine in Cuba that you someday you'll be left without a machine, you know, and you have to know how to think outside the box and save that patient, you know. And so that the interesting thing is that resiliency has been something a part of Cuba and the Cuban physicians that they'll say, I guess era un invento, you know, that's the typical term. Es un invento, you know, like we can say we have to do something, you know, something's gotta happen, you know, to save that patient's life. And so they'll think outside of the box, they'll grab whatever you need and they'll make it and they'll make that patient live, you know, and that just to me is astonishing, you know, like it's just something that you don't get to see every day, you know, the type of resiliency that you see from the Cubans, you know, and you see it everywhere. You don't just see it in medicine. You see it in a day-to-day Cuban that's fixing their car, you know, fixing their máquina, their almendrón, you know, they'll invent something to make that thing run, you know. I'm surprised they haven't used cooking oil to start putting gas inside.
You care about helping others learn and grow. And now you can make an even greater difference. The Ohio State University's fully online master's in applied behavior analysis prepares you to help learners with disabilities thrive. You'll develop the skills to use evidence-based interventions that enhance learning outcomes and foster independence, all in a flexible format designed for working professionals. With growing demand for board-certified behavior analysts, this online program helps you prepare for what's next without pausing your life. If you're ready to expand your impact, Ohio State is ready to support your next step. Visit go.osu.edu/behavioranalysis.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Those machines or something, you know.
Oh, but they have.
Update us.
There's the one that there's a thing. I think NBC did it, and I think BBC World got hold of it. Some guy, I think it was Artemisa, I might get the province wrong, but very close to Havana, some guy mixed, I think it's propane and charcoal to keep it. It's like 1970s Polaquito, you know what I'm talking about, a small kind of car similar to a Fiat, running because there was no gasoline. I think your question of like, Katie, just flipping it and saying, okay, we can talk about how loads of people are dying and it's awful, but also like the resilience. I think it's really important. I'm not a doctor, unlike Uriel, and I'm not particularly well-traveled. That said, I don't know any country or any health system that could resist this like Cuba is. I'm not talking ideologically, I'm talking analytically. Even before we get to health, I'm British, right? As you hear from my accent. If a foreign country imposed an oil blockade on the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, people would be losing their shit in the first hours. There'd be panic in the street, the stock market would crash. And like, again, you talk about sugarcoating, you don't want to lay it on too thick. People are scared. But if you walk around streets, at least where I am in Havana, you kind of be forgiven for thinking it's a normal day. People are suffering. And so it's some sort of mix of a lack of hope and a disempowerment, because it's people say, que vamos a hacer, you know, like this is our lot, suffering, but also this incredible resilience. It's a cliche, of course. I'm a journalist, so I'm allowed to use cliches that they keep. we're allowed to use cliches, AT, but they keep Almendrones, these 1950s Chevys running with coat hangers, but they really do. And the same thing goes for the medical system, you know. They have this department of public healthcare here called Electromedicina, which is medical engineering. These guys are amazing. These guys are engineers that quite literally are losing money to get to work. It's not that they're not earning enough money. It's not that their salary doesn't extend to the end of the month. They're losing money right now to get to work. And they're coming to work out of this sense of public duty. A lot of them are kids. Like I spoke to one guy who's 19. He had to pay the equivalent of $2 a day to get to work, comes to work 5 days a week, and I think he earns $6 a month. Maybe there's a stipend that takes it to 12, but very clear he's losing money just by transport alone. And he raised goats on his dad's farm outside Havana. And he's there like trying to repair incubators from the 1980s, you know? And they have this huge store of old, decrepit, obsolete equipment that in a first world country would have been thrown out literally decades ago. And they keep it going. They keep it going by like finding one piece that goes here and there. And these are keeping people alive. And so like, I don't like hospitals. I don't like the color of them. I just feel a bit funny when I'm there. And so I've got a huge admiration for any doctor, including friends of mine that are doctors that are on six-figure salaries. I don't have words for how much admiration I have for these engineers and these nurses and these doctors and these cleaners that are walking for miles under the Caribbean sun, getting to work, who can barely sleep, who aren't eating properly, and out of a sense of public service are keeping people alive and kind of keeping the show on the road. Because in any other country I know, the bottom would have fallen out a long time ago. These people are fighters.
It's a hard balance because you want to reflect what is actually happening, which is devastating, but then you also want to show the other side. You don't want to overly romanticize.
You've done it well. Both are very true. You're not romanticizing. You capture the reality.
Yeah, exactly right. So it's important to get both of those perspectives. And I think one of the things that I've experienced talking to Cubans is there is a kind of, and I understand why we in not in Cuba, we are struck by their resilience, but there's definitely, I think, resilience fatigue, right? It's like, okay, yes, we're resilient, but we would love to not have to be this resilient. I think that's less so among like doctors and engineers. I think that's more so with just random people who you talk to on the street. Not like I was, you know, embarrassing myself by fawning over them and talking about their resilience, but it would come up, I think.
No, but also you do find examples, right? So I didn't speak to this guy personally, but a source told me she has a friend that's an intensive care doctor. And because the lack of medicine, the lack of machines is so extreme, he had to leave his job for heart problems. He's one that just couldn't anymore. And there has been a mass migration out of medicine, both to the private sector in Cuba and emigrating out of the country over the last few years. And so you find people that resist and you find people that just say, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah. A lot of people were telling me they were like up to here when I was talking to them in Cuba. Uriel, what made you go to medical school in Cuba in the first place? And what are the differences in terms of like the value systems that you find there? I mean, obviously there's a lot of preventative medicine in Cuba, and that's part of out of necessity, but there also is an ideological commitment to that, right? I mean, this is not a profit-based model that they're using. And so sometimes I say when Trump calls Cuba a threat, it is a threat, but it is a threat to a certain model under which we live here, because it doesn't have to be that way, right? Like you don't have to have huge big pharma in order to have innovation, right? That's a myth, right? Cuba has discovered vaccines without the big profit motive. And people are committed to taking care of patients without making money. And we'll get into this later. There's this whole myth about like Cuban doctors being treated as slaves. But tell us what made you go to medical school there in the first place, and then what you learned about their way of doing things.
Well, my journey began when I was in Peru in 2007, when I met Cuban physicians in Peru. There was a big earthquake, like an 8.0 earthquake in Peru, and I was in the middle of the you know, disaster. And all of a sudden, I see in Lima, Peru, you know, these doctors just come in and start helping people, you know, and this, they were Cuban-trained physicians that lived in Peru, you know, and it was just amazing the way they acted, you know, in a moment of disaster, and they were there just, you know, without being paid and anything. And I asked them, you know, where did you guys go to school? And they were like, yeah, we went to school in Cuba. And I was like, oh man, that just struck me, you know. And that story struck with me since I was like 16. And so years later.
And you were just on vacation, or what were you doing?
Yeah, well, I was in vacation in Peru. And so like years later, I was like, I'm just gonna go figure this out and you know, get to Cuba and study medicine. And sure enough, I did. You know, I got a full ride scholarship to study medicine in Cuba. And when I was there, it was just shocking the way the system is built. The system is built primarily in primary care, preventative medicine, which is about 80% of the resources go into preventative medicine, which makes it cost efficient to the society. This is what the bread and butter of Cuban medicine. So, just to give an example, before all this blockade and before the oil blockade and everything, Cuban medicine was elite in a sense where individuals had a clinic right next door, you know? And so individuals that could go anytime to their clinic and see their community doctor. And when they felt sick, they would just, you know, walk on to their local doctor and get taken care of. This leads to a more cost-efficient system because you get less sick people going to the hospital, you know, into the emergency room. And so it was fascinating to me because, you know, I lived in the U.S. my whole life where I grew up without health insurance. And so I was like, man, like, look at this. This kid comes into the clinic and demands healthcare. You know, that like I remember seeing a little kid just come in and he's like, hey, my blood pressure's high, check it. And I was like, wow, that's great.
Not the blood pressure. Yeah. The blood pressure.
And I was like, man, it's just, you can really see how health is a human right there, you know? And it's just, these kids are brought up that way. You know, it's my right to get health, and I demand health. And it's just, it's interesting, you know? And so that's the first thing that shocked me when I studied medicine over there. And after that, I just loved it. You know, I was just, in contrast, I used to work as a paramedic here in Washington State, you know, and it was just hard, you know, children telling their mom, "Hey, mom, I'll pay you when I grow up," you know, words like that. Like, it's just like, why is a kid saying to their mom, "I'll pay you when I grow up," you know, this medical bill that I like. Is just interesting, you know.
Oh, they were saying to the mom, "I'll pay you when I grow up for the cost of this medical bill that you're paying for my treatment."
Exactly. That's wow. Exactly. So it was one of those shocking experiences that I had in contrast with the medical fields here in the U.S. versus in Cuba. And so, just to give an example, but in Cuba, like tertiary care, which is in hospitals, you know, you get less sick individuals in the hospital. So when these individuals come into the hospital, you know, they need basic treatment, basic like 2-day stay at the hospital, and that just saves a lot of money for the government, you know, because, you know, as you know, health is public health in Cuba, and the government pays for everything, you know. And so what was your other question you said?
Oh, well, what made you go there? Then the values, which you've been addressing. But I'm also curious, do they talk about, like, how much of this was informed by Che Guevara and his, is that even part of the medical education? The fact that he was part of the revolution and he was a doctor, or is that not?
Well, they, you know, as an Elam student, and they don't really tell us about Cuban history as much as, you know, the Cubans learn. The Cubans do learn about Cuban history and stuff like that, but they're not allowed to teach us in depth about the Cuban history and stuff like that, because it's just a medical school, you know?
Yeah, it was, we went to this Fidel Castro museum, and it was fascinating to see the different things that they had achieved in terms of healthcare, in terms of education, in terms of child labor. There was a shocking image of a girl. It was so upsetting and heartbreaking. She was like, I think this one was about child poverty, and she was holding like a piece of wood because she didn't have a doll. So she had like a piece of wood that was like wrapped up in a cloth as if it was a doll. But I want you to respond to this claim about doctors as slaves. So this is from the Victims of Communism Foundation. And it says, "A step toward justice with Cuba's medical slavery model." And this is about how doctors, I don't know, are being paid. They start to pay them. But the point is, what is this medical slavery model? I mean, did the doctors you met talk about their labor as if they were being treated like slaves, or?
No, I just want to tell everybody, you know, that what Cubans are built on solidarity. So, so basically, whatever they do it out of their heart. You know, when I speak to these individuals that go out and do these services in other countries, they want to do it. They go out there and they actually get paid pretty good money, because they come back and they buy their cars, they buy their own houses. They're able to expand economically by going out and then coming back to their country. It's quite shocking to see that a lot of people think it's slavery, because these doctors, they love what they do. And they do it. They'll do it in a heartbeat. You know, they leave the country all the time. When they go to Brazil, they go to Venezuela. I've met physicians that go to Congo. They go to all parts of Asia, and then they come back. And I was able to learn from these physicians their experiences and what they did. You know, and it brought a more rich, you know, education. To me and to my colleagues that I had in Cuba, you know.
And what about you, Ed? Have you discovered a slave trade, an undercover slave trade?
Still looking. I've got a slightly different emphasis on it to Yuriel. I do agree that with him that empathy and solidarity and the duty of care to patients, whether they're Cuban or people abroad, is a big part of the Cuban ethos. That's certainly true, and it's certainly taught. Where I'd part company a bit is that, in my experience, most of the doctors these days that work abroad do it because they want to earn more money. Sure, they'd love to travel. Sure, it's a rite of passage. Sure, they're doctors, right? Presumably most of them believe in the Hippocratic Oath. But overwhelmingly what's come back to me is that this is a way that we're going to be able to, I don't know, buy an oven or get an air conditioner or get a TV that's not from the 1980s. This is what I've come across, and I've met dozens of them in my time here. Again, we've talked about not sugarcoating it, and I think it's important not to do that, right? Because we're talking about Cuba and we're all on the left, and there's lots of kind of like romantic myths and stuff that shouldn't be allowed to stand. On the one hand, the notion that they're slaves is crazy, better put, factually false, because I happen to know that often Cuban doctors bribe administrators, a lot of bribery in Cuba, to jump the queue. So what slave would want to pay to be a slave? On the other hand, there are little cubaneo, it's called here. So for example, you know, like Cuba has the stats about how many lives they've saved. And I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a source a couple of weeks ago. We were having a few drinks, and he said, look, Ed, you know, like I was working in Venezuela, I'm really against the US sanctions, they're murderous, that he wants to leave the country because he doesn't think there's much future now. And he said, look, like, don't believe all of the stats, because the Ministry of Public Health really wants to have statistics talking about how many millions of lives we saved. And he said that when he's been on mission, and he's been on five of them, he was under pressure to come up with statistics of how many lives he'd save. And so people would be like, how many lives did he save last month? And he was like, don't know, you know. And they'd be like, surely you saved some, you know, like maybe five would be nice. Surely someone had diarrhea. And he was like, yeah. And they were like, well, what about diarrhea? You know, he could have died. So there's little games here and there. But the notion that they're slaves, or the notion that it's human trafficking, is propaganda. And so what you put up there is something from, I think it's called the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. That is not a serious organization. That's a cutout. They have, to my knowledge, not once have anything published in peer review. They are financed by the US taxpayer. And just to put this in broader context, there is a federally funded disinformation campaign against Cuba, financed to the tune every year, or at least this year, of $52 million a year. Quite a lot with $52 million. You know, the Cuban government doesn't have $52 million to be able to counteract that disinformation. And most mainstream media have been colonized, actually, by those talking points. So you can read in El País, I'm extending a little bit beyond the doctor's thing. But, you know, that there's all these...
In Spain.
Yeah, exactly. That Spain's newspaper reference, right? So a major Rubio talking point is that, oh, you know, after North Korea, Cuba is the major military ally of Putin in Ukraine. And it's true, because a lot of disinformation is rooted in truth. It's true that there's a lot of Cuban poor devils, mercenaries that have gone because their life's so terrible, as they see it. Thousands, I think, hundreds, possibly thousands, that have gone to Ukraine to fight for Russia. But what's not true is that, or at least there's no evidence, that the Cuban government is facilitating it or earning it. The El País is just repeating former CIA people have referred to as regime change industry talking points. That's one. Another one is the hotels, right? So there's Cuba bet on hotels. There's a lot of like kind of ugly hotels that have gone up here. And because of the sanctions, because of the pandemic, and because of very cynical Biden era policies that tell Europeans, if you go to Cuba, you cannot easily come to the United States. Tourism's collapsed. So you've got this kind of like reality created by US economic warfare. And then on another layer, they say, "Oh, but the military, because the military's built a lot of the hotels. The military's just robbing the money. There's billions that they're robbing. They're just sitting on. There's no information to sustain it, and it's paid for by the U.S. taxpayer. And in the terms of the medical missions, the main motor of the Cuban economy, more than even tourism, even in the good times, was the leasing of professional services. Most of that is medical services. And so it just makes sense. If you're John Bolton, if you're Marco Rubio, if you're Mauricio Clavo-Caron, and your quest is to demolish the Cuban economy, well, then you're going to take aim at the main earner, aren't you? And that's what they've done in the medical missions. And so what we can see is that this year, I think 6 or 7 have been closed down in the Caribbean and Central American countries. And they've done that by diplomatic arm twisting, threatening countries that if that they have to kick the Cubans out or else. And that will kill people, right? Those people those doctors are not going to be replaced as much as they say that the US can. And that diplomatic coercion is complemented, to use an ugly word, by this propaganda campaign that they're slaves. And so this is financed by many, many hundreds of thousands or millions a year. No one should take it seriously because there's no evidence offered. But yet the media in the US, basically in NATO countries, has been taken in hook, line, and sinker by it. And it's very concerning that a propaganda operation like that is kind of clunky, you know, like there's actually no evidence. If you're in Cuba, when you speak to the doctors, they're like, yeah, we want to go. We want to go because we earn shit wages, but we want to go. Just the notion that that can kind of take off in the media is just really kind of worrying and a fundamental dereliction of duty. So no, Cuban doctors are not slaves. They're not victims of human trafficking. This is a big disinformation effort and it should be treated with the utmost skepticism.
Yeah. And another, by the way, myth that we were subjected to when we were there was that there was a blackout because of a kneecap concert, which, by the way, it wasn't a kneecap concert. It was like a Cuban musical concert and event. And kneecap was one of the acts, but there are a lot of Cuban acts too. But obviously, anyone who knows this, like, you don't blow out a national grid with one musical concert. It was just so pathetic. And then there was the idea that, you know, oh, they keep the hotels on, but not the hospitals on because they care about hotels more than hospitals. Well, that's because these hotels that are owned by foreign nations and that are corporations are allowed to get the oil that Cuba is not allowed to get. It's not like Cuba is giving these people the petroleum. It's actually like an exception from what the blockade lets in. And they have backup generators. And people were telling me like the best place to live is near a hospital because that's where you're all, like that's where what Cuba prioritizes, not losing power.
They prioritize hotels. They also prioritize hospitals. I live near a hospital so that I have a little bit more power than most people.
Yeah.
They're all protected circuits. That's just the situation.
Right, right. I wanted to ask you guys to react to a video because we know, you know, speaking of Putin, as of Tuesday, a Russian oil tanker carrying around 700,000 at least barrels of oil reached Cuba. And I want to play a video of Trump when he was asked about this Russian oil tanker. This video comes from Sunday. He's, of course, on Air Force One. And here's what he had to say.
Report that the U.S. is going to let a Russian oil tanker go to Cuba. Is that true?
Well, we have a tanker out there. We don't mind having somebody get a boatload because they have to survive.
So that report is true as far as you know?
Well, I would say, I told them, if a country wants to send some oil into Cuba right now, I have no problem with that.
Do you worry that that helps
Vladimir? Whether it's Russia or not, what?
Do you worry that that helps Vladimir Putin, though?
It doesn't help him. He loses one boatload of oil. That's all it is. It's
President,
fine.
President.
If he wants to do that, and if other countries want to do it, it doesn't bother me much. It's not going to have an impact. Cuba's finished. They have a bad regime. They have very bad and corrupt leadership. And whether or not they get a boat of oil, it's not going to matter. I'd prefer letting it in, whether it's Russia or anybody else, because the people need heat and cooling and all of the other things that you need. Go ahead.
So why doesn't he let it in? Okay, so just to review what he said here, he said, if a country wants to send some oil into Cuba right now, I have no problem with that. And then the reporter says, do you worry that helps Vladimir Putin? Of course, that's the priority for this reporter, not that there's an illegal blockade. And Trump says it doesn't help him. He loses one boatload of oil. That's all it is. It doesn't bother me. And then, of course, at the end, he says how much he would love to. He wants the oil to get in as if that's not his policy that's preventing it from getting in. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah, he says he loses one boatload of oil. That's about Putin. And then he says, doesn't bother me. It's not going to have an impact. Cuba is finished. They have a very bad regime. They have very bad and corrupt leadership. And whether or not they get a boat of oil, it's not going to matter. But yeah, he says he'd prefer it if they get it because they need it. Is he being modest? I mean, doesn't he realize it's because of him? Anyway, but yeah, what are your guys' responses to that video?
To be honest, I just think it's the same contradictory speeches he's had all the time. You know, he says one thing, he says the other thing, and then it's just at the end of the day, he's going to do whatever he wants. And it's annoying, you know, it's aggravating. Because he's playing with people's lives. There's no reason why, you know, a president that acts like a little kid should be in charge or in control of people's lives like this. You know, it's devastating. It's ridiculous. And most of the time he just says a bunch of nonsense just to get people mad and aggravated with the situation. Those are my comments, and it's ridiculous. It gets me mad. It does. It gets me mad. It's the same speech he's had it always with everything, you know.
And Ed, what do you think, though, in terms of, I mean, is this, I think I heard you talking about this on another show, but like, Trump does this a lot. He empowers adversaries, right? Like, now you have the Cuban people who have Russia to thank for oil. They're going to be, I mean, they probably were already rooting for this, right? But obviously it's in the interest of, how does even like the Iran war relate to the fate of the Cuban people?
Well, when Barack Obama normalized relations with Cuba, just a shade over 10 years ago, sorry, 10 years ago this month, he visited, one of the major arguments from the Democratic establishment and from the US establishment at large, CIA, Pentagon, Coast Guard, etc., was that if we don't engage, we being the United States, Russia and China will get in. They'll move into the vacuum. And so there was a very serious, you know, traditional mainstream national security argument for the normalization. And the US establishment was very, very happy to normalize because for the first time in over 50 years, Obama and his people had wrenched policy away from the Cuban-American lobby in Miami that had captured it for the last 50 years and aligned it into what U.S. elites saw and still see as U.S. national interest. And so it's interesting reporting on Cuba right now because you see that in real time, in almost an accelerated pace, presuming the U.S. doesn't manage to overthrow Cuba, it might not, but it doesn't look like it's going to be overthrown anytime soon, from what I see on the street. Presuming that the government or regime, if you prefer, stays in place, you're seeing that the U.S. is welding the Cuban government and the Cuban people to U.S. adversaries. Cuba needs Iran to keep on winning the war. Why? Well, a source told me that spoke to Trump a few days ago. We have to see what happens in Iran first before we move on Cuba. Trump has repeatedly threatened military intervention in Cuba just a couple of days ago. He did it last time. So obviously, any country in Cuba's position would say, you know, go Iran, you know, like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. If Cuba's going to get out of this latest jam, it's not going to be by defeating a U.S. invasion on Bay of Pigs, like they did in 1961, it's going to be doing one of the fastest green energy transitions in the history of humankind when you're all but broke. And so they need two countries to help them to do that. Russia to send the dirty oil to keep the lights on more or less in the meantime, as we saw today. And China, which I understand is giving them very, very soft credit in order for them to be putting solar panels up. So we're seeing Iran, Russia, China, all of which the Cuban government and people, I mean, the Cuban people were relieved today when these people I spoke to, that the Russian oil arrived. And it's not hard to understand why. They understand that means a little bit more food, slightly fewer power cuts, maybe a bit more medicine. Maybe you can, you know, visit your grandma who lives the other side of the street because maybe some of the oil will be refined into diesel and you can afford a cab. I mean, these are like bread and butter issues. And U.S. adversaries are actually, if you want to put it into like this language, providing human rights while the US is like systematically and intentionally destroying them. And so you can just imagine people in the National Security Council or Democrats or like kind of right-thinking Republicans just thinking, oh my God, what are we doing here? I'd say the other thing that about the Russian oil tanker is that I spell a taco. This is a taco, isn't it? I mean, this is a Trump always chickens out. Yet another one. We don't have to go back too many weeks when Trump was saying no oil's getting in, they're on the brink of collapse, no oil's getting in, they're going down for a count. Compare that to what you just played a few minutes ago. Oh, no, I don't mind if the oil's getting in.
And that's Trump always chickens out, by the way, if people don't know. Yeah, tacos, Trump always chickens out, yeah.
It's a big fat chickens out. And like, not only have the Supreme Court voided the tariff threat, but is it really accurate what's been framed in Western media that the Trump administration decided to let Russia in? I don't know. I don't have that insight. But that kind of presumes that they have the moral right to. But more importantly, away from like the normative and towards like realpolitik, were they really going to stop the Russians? I mean, they chickened out with the Chinese. It looks like he's chickened out with the Iranians. And so I think it's an embarrassing U-turn with them. I just think you need to have a bit of not even historical memory memory for a few weeks. And I think it's very notable that the Cubans didn't, for right or wrong, strategically, they didn't offer these big concessions that we had this whole media blitz about. They have to offer this because they're about to crumble and they're about to crumble and they're teetering on the edge. And the Cubans basically said, you know, you had Jose Vina Fidel, who's one of the most senior foreign diplomats here, say, we think in the future the United States can participate in the country's economic development. In other words, they're giving them diddly, and they weathered it. And I think right now, March 31st, the world looks a rather different place than it did on the 3rd of January, when I think a lot of Latin American countries were just dazzled by the success of the abduction of Maduro. And so I think the Cubans today will be a lot more, the Cuban government, I would say, will be a lot more sleeping more soundly than they were a week ago. It's not insignificant at all, not just that the Russians got in, but that the Trump rhetoric has U-turned on this.
Yeah, that framing is insane. Trump allowed a Russian oil tanker to reach Cuba, breaking the island's fuel blockade. That's what CNN won. I wanted to, you guys have been so generous with your time and you're both so hardworking, but if you'll indulge me, I have one more short video to show and then one more question. So let's take a look at this video, which is, I blame you, Ed, because you basically refer to it. It's the A2 Trump. Trump had some interesting comments. Let's just take a look at this clip of Trump's comments about Cuba.
And I'm hearing them saying, could he be losing the MAGA base? I don't think so. You know why? Because MAGA wants to win, number one. Number two, they want our country protected. They don't want another country out there that's hostile and crazy to have a nuclear weapon. And number three, they like us protecting certain allies, whether it's Israel or Saudi Arabia or Qatar or UAE. Any of them, they want that. MAGA wants strength and they want victory. They want success. And that's what we have. And we have been very, very successful. You know, when I went into Venezuela, I said, because I campaigned on the fact peace through strength, you wouldn't have to use it. I said, you'll never have to use it. And Cuba's next, by the way. But pretend I didn't say that, please. Pretend I didn't say that. Please, 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 media, please. Disregard that statement. Thank you very much.
That was from Friday at the investment forum in Miami. So, yeah, it's interesting. Would love to cross-cut that with the image of the tanker coming in. It's pretty disgusting, though. I guess he thinks it's funny. But speaking of Cuba being next, I guess the last thing I want to ask is, and this is more for you, Ed, because you're there right now. You know, something that I heard from people in Cuba was a couple of people said this to me, like, with all due respect to the Venezuelans, we wouldn't let happen here what happened there. And of course, I also met Cubans who were like, no, our government needs to negotiate because I'm up to here. We need a change. But I did think it was interesting. A couple of people brought up the what happened in Venezuela couldn't happen here. What is your sense of what Cubans are prepared to do or not prepared to do? And obviously, it's not a monolith. So what are the different responses you've encountered?
Well, I'll try and lay it out. So there's 9 to 10 million Cubans probably in the island at the moment. There's been massive migration. It's definitely fair to say that the government is unpopular, given the enormity of the economic crisis. It does have some popular support still, mainly amongst elderly sections of the population, but it's certainly unpopular. Everyone agrees that change is necessary. You know, everyone from like Raul Castro to the dissidents, because how could it not be necessary? Look out. There's a power cut here, and I'm in one of the poshest parts of the city. And people are hungry and don't have medicine, as we've spoken about. So everyone wants change. There's consensus about that. Where do the differences start coming in? What type of change, right? So you meet a lot of people that say we want change within the system, that don't think that it's a realistic proposition to have free and fair elections in Cuba, and I don't think Cuba is a democracy, by the way, but they don't think that it's that think that it's fantastically naive, the notion that you could have a democracy, let's say, while the country's under such massive external pressure, as it always has been for the last two-thirds of a century. And so they want change, let's say, within the revolution. You meet plenty of other people that say we want capitalism, we want democracy, we want human rights, we want, you know, higher living standards. That is to say, we want change outside the revolution. That's to say, we want, you know, something else. We want to hell with these leaders. You get a lot of that. Which one predominates in Cuba? I genuinely don't know. There's no polls here. There's no way of knowing. These people that favour a military option, US military. Well, that's not a fringe view. It's certainly not a substantial minority view. You know, maybe for every 10 people you meet, you might find one that when you push them will say they still want that. So overwhelmingly, the Cuban population is against military intervention. And I think that Donald Trump, with his like provocative statements, has really helped the Cuban government by creating a rally around the flag effect, right? You know, like Cubans know their history. They know that from the first part of the 20th century until the 59 revolution, this country was to a great extent run politically and economically by the United States. And it's fascinating to see that we spoke briefly about the disinformation, you know, like the bullshit industry, the cottage industry from Florida, a lot of it in Washington. It's financed quite well, about $52 million a year. Trump, when he says things like, we're going to have a friendly takeover, I'm going to take Cuba, I can take it, I can do what I want with it, he's basically taking an axe to all of this, these hundreds of millions of dollars of investments over decades in this bullshit that the US cares about democracy and human rights in Cuba. And so it's quite interesting because he's kind of undermining what has been carefully curated for a long, long time. And so it strengthens the hand of the government. And in the same way, that there'd been a lot of investments for a lot of time saying that no hay bloqueo, there isn't a blockade, there's no embargo. Marco Rubio is on record as having said that a couple of years ago. There's a lot of propaganda here that gets into people's cell phones and stuff, on, you know, social media, that there's no embargo. There's, you know, they cherry pick silly exceptions. Like, you know, you can buy chicken in the United States and therefore there's no sanctions. It's completely irrational, but it kind of... It works because people are just so fed up and angry. Well, they have an effective oil blockade that has been punctured today, but that's still more or less their policy, and they boasted about it. So those that try and make out disingenuously that there are no sanctions, they're in a tough spot right now. And so I think that the thing I'd end with saying is that Cubans are nationalists, right? Whether they support the government or they're against it, the notion that another country is going to run their affairs, the notion that Cuban problems are not for Cubans to sort out, the notion that Donald Trump, when he says he's going to take Cuba, the notion that the majority of the population administration will side with that, the army has got a terrible equipment problem and terrible petrol problem. But my understanding is it's very professional and loyal and will fight. And there's a sector, a minority sector of the population in Cuba, that will also fight if there's an invasion. Now, could they beat the United States? I think struggle to find a military analyst that would suggest that. But there's a big section of the population that would fight. And I'm just seeing on social media, Cubans that I know, many of them, posting pictures of themselves with rifles and stuff on training camps because they would resist in all ways possible a foreign attempt at occupying their country.
Well, thank you so much, Oriad. Any final words from you?
Well, I just want to say, you know, I constantly send medical supplies to Cuba. So if anybody wants to donate to my nonprofit, www.pan-american.org, you can go and send me some funds to buy medical supplies and send them to the William Soler Hospital. That would be greatly appreciated.
We'll put a link. Great. Say that address again.
So www.pan-american.org.
Pan as in P-A-N, yeah. As in Peter?
P-A-N-american.org.
Okay, I think I put it in there. Great. Thank you so much. And yes, definitely please come back. And thank you so much to both of you for what you're doing. I'm going to stay on and read some super chats and show also some slides from Cuba. But you guys are welcome to do whatever. Enjoy the blackout. Enjoy the non-blackout. How are you going to get home, Ed?
I just live a few blocks away.
Oh, okay. Great.
I've got a torch. Thanks, Katie. Love to meet you, Odile.
Thank you, everybody.
Have a great night. Another killer combo. I love these combinations. They're so great. So I also want to show people some of the cool things that you have to look forward to. I did a little carousel. I believe that's what the kids call it on Instagram. And these are things that you can look forward to seeing soon. If you're Patreon supporters, you're going to get to see them sooner rather than later. Here again is me and Jeremy Corbyn. Nathan Robinson took that photo. Oh, we have a hilarious video that Nathan needs to send me of Jeremy Corbyn being told something hilarious by children. This young Chomsky from QAnon took this photo. It's an actual film photograph. This is me and Gerardo Hernandez from the Cuban Five, who I interviewed. Fascinating, fascinating story. This guy was in jail for being a spy when really actually what he was he was doing intelligence gathering on Cuban American terrorists who were bombing planes and hotels and killing people. Here's Kneecap. We got a little interview with Kneecap. That was great. It was really cool. We just sat right behind them. They're as down to earth as you would think and hope. And they're great on Palestine. They're very openly pro-Palestine, but they're also really great on Cuba. So I had a short little interview with them. Here's Anne Wright. I did a little interview with her. Anne Wright has been on the show. She's great. She's also a retired colonel. She resigned from the State Department over Iraq. So we spoke on the Malecón. Here is a great Cuban neurologist who I had a teeny, very quick interview with about Alzheimer's treatment. Here is Fidel Castro and Salvador Allende. And this was at a medical building that is named after Salvador Allende, who himself was a doctor. He was, of course, the president of Chile who was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup on September 11th, 1973. This is Jeremy Corbyn again, and this is someone I ran into who was going to represent Elian Gonzalez's father in getting Elian back. He's a lawyer. But then Clinton and Janet Reno did that raid and got him back. This is me with Liz Oliva, who we've had on the show. She's from Belly of the Beast, which is from whose office Ed was joining us. Here is Ryan Grimm from Dropsite News, Reed Lindsay, who's with Belly of the Beast, and me at a dinner. And This is going to be a surprise. You'll see. And this is Lavish. And I were held detained and questioned. He said that now getting new phone, we're free. And what's interesting is I actually interviewed Lavish right before we got detained, right before we took the flight from Havana to Miami. And I actually asked him about ICE because he's from Minneapolis. So here's a little clip of the interview that I did with Lavish right before we got detained. Can you tell me your name, where you're from, and what you came to Cuba for?
Yo, my name's Lavish. I came to Cuba to hand out over $500,000 of humanitarian aid amongst the Nuestra convoy.
Had you been here before?
This is my first time.
What do you think?
Definitely transformative, eye-opening. And really putting things into perspective as Cuba's history as kind of the heart of the revolution against the empire that America is.
What did you see that was the most surprising or inspiring or upsetting?
I think a lot of countries that are under occupation have such a level of dignity that they maintain this dogged strength through the oppression. And just seeing that resiliency is always a reminder to say, "Fuck America." But it was beautiful.
You're from Minneapolis.
Yeah, I'm from Minneapolis.
What kind of work do you do there?
Minneapolis lately, I was gone for a while and I just came back after Renee Good was killed, which is just a couple blocks away from where my mom lived, six blocks away from where my dad lived. I grew up right next to where George Floyd was killed. Alex Pretty was killed a couple blocks away from where I went to school as a kindergartner to fifth grade. So it's really rooted in our collective liberation and on the ground coverage and standing in solidarity with not just ourselves here, but that imperial boomerang of what's happening abroad and how we have to fight against it here.
There's a lot more. It's really interesting when we get to talk about ICE and Minneapolis, because again, this is literally like an hour before we were both pulled over and detained. We have a cool thing to show you. I did a really great interview with Struggle 4, which is a really cool stream. I don't know if you guys watch it, but that is on their stream. I'll put in a link to Stephanie and Marcus. That was that couple I showed, and I was like, oh, that's a surprise, because I was going to surprise you with that stream, but I don't have it on hand, so I will link to that. Thank you so much to our new Patreon supporters, and I'm talking to you, Joyce. I don't know if you want your full names, like your last name, so I'm just going to do first names. Thank you, Joyce. Thank you, Guy. Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Invalid. Thank you, Rafiq. Thank you so much. I'm very excited. I'm very excited by all the Patreon supporters we got. And I will do this again next week. So it's very exciting to get it in real time. And again, we literally couldn't do this without your support. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Phantomist Fanta. Thank you, Bradley, or Brad as you're known. Thank you, Nate. Thank you, Charlotte. And I will see you all at least next week on Tuesday, if not before then. Oh, if you want to see this full thing, again, most of this, if you've watched it live, you're in luck. But if you want to see some special gems from the interviews, you can do that at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Also, we'll be releasing some of our really cool Cuba footage. And to get that sooner rather than later, please join patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Bye, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.